Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. Parents can send instant money transfers, automate allowance, and more. Plus, keep an eye on spending with real-time notifications. Join more than 6 million families building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get your first month free at greenlight.com/odyssey. That's greenlight.com/odyssey. Want to teach your kids financial literacy, but not sure where to start? Greenlight can help. With Greenlight, parents can keep an eye on kids' spending and saving, while kids and teens use a card of their own to build money confidence. As a parent, you can send instant money transfers, set up chores, automate allowance, and more. It's a convenient way to run your household, customized to your family's needs, and the easy way to raise financially smart kids. Get started with Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/odyssey.
Hello and welcome to The Sidebar, presented by True Crime Daily, taking you inside the courtrooms of high-profile and notorious cases from across the country. I'm your host, Joshua Ritter. I'm a criminal defense lawyer based in Los Angeles and previously an LA County prosecutor for nearly a decade. You can find me on all social media at Joshua Ritter ESQ or at joshuaritter.com. We are recording this on Friday, May 3rd, 2024. In this week's episode, a father who allegedly forced his six-year-old son to run on a treadmill because he believed the boy was too fat faces a first-degree murder charge following the boy's death, plus a TikTok star charged with the double murder of his wife and her male companion. But first, trial begins for a woman charged with murdering her police officer boyfriend in a case where her defense cries conspiracy and cover-up. Today, we are joined by Natalie Whittingham Burrell, a public defender, legal analyst, and YouTuber you can find at Natalie Lawyer Chick. Natalie, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me, Josh. It's nice to be here.
Absolutely. I've been looking forward to this because I know I've watched your show on YouTube a few times, and I know that you follow these cases very closely, especially this Karen Reed one, which I want to jump into first, because it's amazing to me that a case that I feel like trials like this are taking place across the country all the time. And for some reason, this one caught fire, and it's really got both that local community, but now even on a national level, people really interested in this case. And we'll get into a little bit why that might be and what the mystery is surrounding it. But let's just catch people up really quickly. Trial kicked off this week for a Boston woman accused of killing her boyfriend by running him over with her SUV, leaving him to die in a blizzard. Opening statements were presented on Monday in the high-profile and contentious murder trial of Karen Reed. Reed faces charges in connection with the 2022 death of her boyfriend, Officer John O'Keefe. Through the first 2 days of testimony, jurors heard from family members of O'Keefe, along with police officers and firefighters who responded to the scene of his death in January of 2022. Responding personnel testified to a chaotic scene in which O'Keefe was laying face up as Reed was attempting to give him CPR. She had blood on her mouth and was described as distraught and screaming. Reed's defense team wasted no time attacking police protocols, questioning why investigators didn't go into the home or talk to the homeowners where O'Keefe was found. So far, three of the responding firefighters and paramedics have testified that Reed was heard to be repeating the phrase, "I hit him," again and again. Trial is expected to last 6 to 8 weeks. Natalie, I'm just going to let you jump right in. What are your impressions so far? Who's the one bringing the punches in this case so far?
Oh, absolutely. I have a lot of thoughts on this case. In my opinion, the defense is really bringing it here. I think that what's really interesting about this case is that before I started watching the trial, I heard in passing that they were going to be advancing a defense that the police were framing Karen Reed for the death of her boyfriend, for hitting him with her car and driving away. And it almost made me laugh because the idea of the police framing someone is, you know, it's just very rare that something like that, this widespread conspiracy could even happen. And so it was hard to take that allegation seriously until I heard the opening statement and the way that the cross-examination is going. The defense here did their own independent investigation, which is not something that every defense attorney is always able to do in every single case, because sometimes the case is just about attacking the prosecution's case and pointing out their weaknesses. And they're doing more than that here. They had their own theory that the police participated in this cover-up. Lending credence to that theory is the main detective, the lead investigator on the case, showing a bias and a lack of a complete investigation here. So I do think that there's some credibility to the defense's case, and just the courtroom presentation from the defense is far better than what the prosecution is presenting at this point in time.
Yeah, I agree. They're obviously talented and seasoned defense attorneys. And in full disclosure, I was a former law partner with Alan Jackson, who's one of the lead defense attorneys on the case. I've known him for a very long time. He's a very talented lawyer. And one of the things that he always said is that you have to have every case has to have a villain. Every case has to have a bad guy. And if that is not your client, then you have to give the jury who that is. And they've demonstrated that remarkably in this case with, like you said, making the police the bad guy. It's the police department who's the villain in this case. They're the ones responsible for this whole cover-up. And I think they've established that theme. And like you said, they're continuing to present it throughout their cross-examination. But I agree with what you were saying. Your initial reaction is, too, that it's a big thing to have jurors swallow this whole mass conspiracy and all the moving parts involved in it. And that was one of my questions to you, is the prosecution's theory is that she hit him with her car and then left him to die. Mm-hmm. But they still have to establish that she did that knowingly and with some sort of bad intent, mm-hmm. knew that she hit him and knew that he was injured to the point that he would die. Mm-hmm. Whereas it seems like to me, a built-in theory of defense might be, I didn't know I hit him, or if I did hit him, it was an accident. But instead, the defense is saying she never hit him. Mm-hmm. He was beaten inside the home and the police are involved in this cover up. Why do you think they went for this kind of shoot the moon, riskier, winner takes all sort of defense here?
Right. Because we know that it's difficult to do two defenses in front of a jury. You just don't do that. You pick one. And they pick the one that for most legal practitioners usually doesn't pass the smell test for us. Right. But I think here they really do have the evidence, you know, to back it up. The gentleman had on him scars that were consistent with dog bites. They had a family dog that was a German Shepherd that no one knows where that dog is now. You had the fact that the plow person drove in and out of the area and didn't see a dead body there. And also the fact that the EMTs and the first responders, it was actually just one of the first responders that heard her saying that. Other ones said that they saw the blood on her face and that they could hear that she was, you know, freaking out and everything, but that they didn't necessarily hear her say that she's the one that hit him. It was one EMT that said that he heard her hit him. And that really, that could be interpreted as her fear, like, I fear that I hit him. Did I hit mm-hmm. him? I don't know that I hit him. But that doesn't mean that she actually committed the crime. And then you have those communications and the phone records, which this is the first time I've ever seen the prosecutor call into question Cellebrite data. That's usually what they, you know, rely upon. And they're saying that these cell phone records that show that the lead detective expressed bias against her, I think is evident, could be evidence towards a cover up, which it's kind of distasteful to even have to allege that. But there's evidence to back up what they're saying. And so I think that's why they went with it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree with you. You have to pick an argument. If you try to give them the whole, my client didn't do it, but if she did do it, it was an accident, you're losing credibility. I agree with you. So there is some method behind this, far more aggressive and riskier, though, I think, defense strategy. I want to get back to, because one of the linchpin pieces of evidence for the prosecution is what's coming out in court now. And it is this idea of I hit him. And you're saying that only one person heard it. I think others have testified to something along the lines of telling other investigators that that's what they heard. There's some discussion about, was she saying it in response to questions, or was she telling other people, or who was she talking to? But so far, I feel, at least my assessment is that that has been fairly well established that somebody heard her say that. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, and you kind of touched on this, but how does the defense had that handle that? Let's say that is what she said. Okay. Mm-hmm. And the jury believes that. How do they deal with that?
Yeah, I think they'd have to reinterpret that information. And they kind of did it in their opening. They signaled it. And they said, you know, that wasn't a declaration. That was a question, is basically how they. So it's, you know, here he is laid out. That's the last place that she saw him. She dropped him off there. Oh, my God, did I hit him? Now, of course, the prosecution is going to say, why would anyone jump to that conclusion? But, you know, it could just be, you know, grief, fear, and just less of her saying that she hit him and asking, did I hit him? Or, you know, I hit him. You know, it's all about tone of voice, facial expression, yeah, and just bringing doubt. That's all they have to do. Doubt that she was making some type of confession. I think it's the state's best evidence, but they can raise doubt about whether or not she meant that she was confessing that she hit him, or if right, she was asking those around her, did I hit him?
Yeah, no, you're right. It's a very different statement if you realize that it's either her confessing, here's what I did, or her coming to the realization of perhaps this is what happened, right? And it sounds like even her mental and emotional state at that time may have made lend itself more towards the latter, that she's kind of, you know, if she's even saying I hit him, it might be a question in itself. I hit him, like this shocked moment. And still, like I said, with the prosecution, even if they get to that point, that does not make it a murder. I mean, they still are going to have to prove that she did it on purpose or knew that she hit him and left him to die. There's a lot of other hoops they're going to have to jump through beyond just whether or not her vehicle, in fact, hit him. So yeah, fascinating case. It's supposed to go on for another 6 to 8 weeks or so. Today, I believe they're doing a jury view of the scene. So that'll be interesting. We will continue to watch this one and update all you folks as we have them. But really fascinating case. And now I think everyone's beginning to understand why it has caught so much attention.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify is got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
Hi, this is Amy Poehler here to tell you about a new improvised show from Paper Kite Podcasts, the team that brought you Say More with Dr. Sheila. Check out our new parody podcast, Women Talking About Murder. It's a show about women talking about murder. Every episode features special guests, twists, turns, and the mystery of a missing co-host. Available on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
Let's move to Toms River, New Jersey, where a father charged with first-degree murder in the death of his 6-year-old son is currently facing trial after forcing the boy to run on a treadmill to the point of exhaustion. According to prosecutors, Christopher Greger, as seen on surveillance footage, is in the apartment's gym repeatedly forcing his son, Corey Micciolo, to run, allegedly because the father thought that the boy was too fat. In the video, the boy reportedly stumbles and falls as Greger continues to increase the speed, with the father forcefully pulling the child up and demanding him to continue running. 2 weeks after the alleged incident, the child was taken to a hospital after Greger noticed his son short of breath, slurring his words, and suffering from nausea. The child began to have seizures and died in the hospital shortly after. An autopsy cited the cause of death as the result of blunt force injuries, along with contusions to his liver and heart, combined with acute inflammation and sepsis. While the manner of death was ruled indeterminate, a later review of the autopsy deemed the child's death a homicide and Greger was charged with murder. But the father maintains the child's death was the result of natural causes and complications from pneumonia. Greger shared custody with the boy's mother at the time of the death, and she claims that she reported Greger over 100 times for child abuse. However, no actions were ever taken. The father faces a potential life sentence if convicted and previously turned down a 30-year plea offer in the case. Natalie, I don't know if you've seen the video in this case, but it's really disturbing to see this young man just struggling, and you can tell it breaks your heart because you can tell he's both in fear of and trying to please his father. But from a legal perspective, there's a problem here, right? Between what is captured on video, did that actually cause the boy's death? Mm-hmm. And if it did, do you see where I'm going with this kind mm-hmm. of disconnect? Is that it's obvious we're witnessing abuse, but are we witnessing the beginnings and makings of a murder, I guess is my question.
Right. And then we also have to remember that there's no way to know what happened in between that horrible treadmill torture and the time that he passed away. So we're just assuming that's the only physical abuse that precipitated his death. So, you know, it's tough here because whenever there's a span of time that elapses between the moment of the assault and the moment of passing away, that is an opportunity to raise doubt from the defense perspective of things. So what the prosecution is going to need to do is to get an expert medical doctor, probably somebody in pediatrics, to say that this type of abuse could lead to those types of injuries which led to the death. I don't know that the defense will have their own expert, nor do they have to. They do not have a burden of production. But if the prosecution has a medical doctor, then it does help the defense if they have their own medical doctor to contend against what the prosecution's doctor is saying, what they call a battle of the experts. But if they don't have a medical doctor on the defense side, it's going to make things a lot harder. But just as a human being, watching that, you play that video in front of a jury, and I don't think he stands a very good chance, no matter what the medical say. They could just have a visceral reaction to that alone. But yes, causation will be the key issue here for the prosecution. That's where they're going to have an uphill battle, but it's not impossible for them.
Yeah, no, I'm so glad you brought out that last point. That was something I wanted to talk to you about, is that sometimes, and I'm sure you've seen this, there is something that is so emotionally impactful to a jury that the law and the elements and everything else kind of seems to take a backseat. And I'm wondering if you think that'll take place here or is likely to take place here with the reaction you have to watching that. You're so disgusted that it seems like, you know, when you start getting down to causation and nexus and all of these other legal issues, they might just say, you know what? I saw what you did to that young man. I don't really care at this point.
That's exactly right. And if the prosecution is strategic about their charging document, they're not just charging murder. They're charging child abuse. Yeah. They're charging neglect. Because if he wants to say this child had pneumonia and that caused the child to die, why didn't you take the child to the hospital sooner if the child died from pneumonia? Because it's 2024. Usually kids aren't dying from that. So if he went on for so long being sick without you taking him to the hospital, that's also neglect resulting in the death of the child. So they're going to have to be very, very careful with their charging document to not just try to shoot for the moon, as we said with the previous case. You want to make sure that you have those insurance charges in there, the lower charges that may carry less time, but will ensure that you get a conviction, because they may have a hard time with this murder charge, but they would not have a hard time with a child abuse charge.
Very difficult case to defend, I imagine. I do not envy the defense attorney in this case, and I understand he's doing a very admirable job, but it's hard to stand there and make a very nuanced and legal argument about, you know, you don't have proof of my client's actions actually causing this death when jurors have had to sit through, and they've shown that video more than once. Jurors are no matter how many times you know this, no matter how many times you give them instructions, they're at the end of the day just people who are going to kind of do what they feel is the right thing. And so sometimes that works out and sometimes it doesn't.
Right.
Finally, we move to San Diego, California, where a prominent TikTok star is facing a murder trial where he's expected to testify in his own defense. Ali Abulaban, who went by Jin Kid on TikTok, faces two counts of first-degree murder for the deaths of his wife, Anna Abulaban and Rayburn Barron, who were executed in a luxury apartment in October of 2021. The couple had lived together in the residence with their 5-year-old daughter before Anna allegedly kicked Ali out as their marriage deteriorated amid claims of violence and infidelity. Ali reportedly became concerned that his wife was unfaithful, and his suspicions led the man to bug his daughter's iPad with an audio listening device before the fatal incident. Upon hearing a man's voice and laughing, Ali allegedly returned to the home where his wife and Barron were later found dead. Prosecutors claim the killings were the cold, calculated actions of a scorned lover, while Ali's defense contends that the alleged murders were the heat of passion actions of a man who was mentally and emotionally pushed to his breaking point. In what could be a pivotal move for his defense, Ali is expected to take the stand in the trial, which is underway at the time of this recording, and we will, of course, keep you updated as that case develops. All right, Natalie. The crime itself and who committed it doesn't seem to really be in dispute in this case. And it seems as though the defense strategy is to essentially concede that. And it sounds like even from the evidence, he confessed essentially to investigators. So arguing that path, that he didn't have anything to do with it, seems like a losing strategy. But what do you think the defense is trying to accomplish here by having him take the stand?
I would think that defenses like this, like heat of passion, even self-defense, a lot of the times it is about the not only the objective, what would a reasonable person do in this situation, but also the subjective, was your client actually, you know, just overcome and lost all rationality because of coming upon the scene. And so there's really no other way to get that out without your client's testimony. And that's why you would put him on the stand. And also, it could help to humanize him in front of the jury, because so far, everything that they're going to be hearing will be from the state's version of events, which will be really horrible for him. But of course, there is also the possibility that someone who put a tracking device and then turned around and killed their wife may not come across too well on the witness stand. So they could, you know, I don't know how he presents, what his attitude is like, but that could also backfire depending on how he presents to the jury.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. I think this was one of those cases where they, you know, this isn't them being clever, this is them having no choice. And what they're doing too, they're not trying to argue a defense that will get an acquittal out of this case. They're essentially asking the jury for a manslaughter. They're saying this is heat of passion. He's responsible, but there's an explanation as to why you shouldn't view this as some sort of cold-hearted murder. And you're right, you can only get that through him. But boy, he is going to really have to perform on the stand, right? Yeah. I mean, if there's any indication that he's got crocodile ears up there, mm-hmm. they'll be done with him, don't you think?
Right, exactly. So your client, in cases where it's really only their word, and it happens a lot of times in homicides, right? Where it's a self-defense claim or a heat of the passion claim or imperfect self-defense, you need them to impress upon the jury that had it not been for this extreme circumstance, they would never be here. My goodness, but if they come across as though they're cold, calculating, unremorseful, or have hatred towards the decedents, then the jury is going to definitely hate them. So it is just such a big gamble.
Yeah. I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'm sure you've had cases that you've handled yourself where your clients have confessed. I know from having been a prosecutor that if that my boss would hand me a file and they're walking me through what the facts are, and they say, and by the way, he confessed, I'm like, okay, hand me the file. I'm done here. That's all I need to know. I'm sure from the defense side of things, it's got to have the opposite effect. And by the way, your client copped out to the whole thing. How do you approach those cases?
Well, I'll tell you this. I spend a lot of time in Fifth Amendment motions to suppress those.
Yeah.
That's like, because, you know, the confession, even though people don't think of themselves as confessing, oh, I just told them, you know, I was there, but I didn't start it. Well, then you've confessed to your presence at the scene, which they didn't have before that. They didn't have any evidence. You were there outside of what you just said. So thank you for that. So a lot of the times we're trying to suppress those because we're trying to make sure that their Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights weren't violated. And then if there is no resolution after, you know, there's a straight up confession or somehow your client has implicated themselves and you have to take the case to trial, you have to come up with an explanation for why your client didn't really mean to say that they did it. Or you have to in some way come up with an alternative defense that is a mitigating defense, such as, like you said, like with manslaughter. So you have a confession and a homicide, then you'll have to in some way say that this was imperfect self-defense, or, you know, something like that, or battered women syndrome or something like that. But it's really, really tough. You know, a lot of the times the best evidence against your client is their own words.
I fully agree. I think there's something psychologically that takes place with jurors where all of those nagging questions they may have had about, you know, is DNA and fingerprints and even videotape and everything else, you hear it come out of the defendant's mouth and they're kind of like, well, I can sleep well at night now. I know this guy admitted to the whole thing. So it's kind of like it takes all the guesswork out of their hands. It's very powerful and very difficult to deal with. But I think, like you pointed out, that might be why they're arguing for manslaughter here than anything else. And they might have a chance too, because jurors, I also think, when offered a way for the defendant to take responsibility that seems to satisfy everybody in the room's concerns, they might just go for it.
Right.
Natalie, as always, this was an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much. Thank you for coming on. Where can people find out more about you and your YouTube channel?
Thank you for having me, Josh. It's always a pleasure. You can find me on YouTube at Natalie Lawyerchick and on Twitter at Nat Lawyerchick. And you can find me on Instagram at Natalie Lawyerchick YouTube.
Fantastic. You guys should definitely check it out. I'm your host, Josh Ritter. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Joshua Ritter ESQ or at joshuaritter.com. You can find our sidebar episodes wherever you get your podcasts, and we want to hear from you. If you've got questions or comments you'd like us to address, tweet us your questions with the hashtag TCD Sidebar. And thank you for joining us at the True Crime Daily Sidebar.